4 years ago, on a cold spring day in 2008, I was wandering around Menards trailing Wendell Brain. I was not stalking him, besides what you may think. I was Wendell's glorified gopher, one of the many titles I held during my tenure here, and interestingly, one of the titles that Nate by now has probably expunged from the youth minister job description, hopefully. If there was one thing Wendell and I did well as a team while I was here, it was build shelves. Am I right? Yes. You'll find our handiwork throughout the church, actually. And by team, I clearly mean that Seth holds the brackets in place, Seth carries the wood to the saw, Seth runs back to the closet dozens of times to find screws, Seth does all these things while Wendell does the work. However, to be honest, my role being reduced to brute manual labor has probably due less to Wendell's type A leadership than it was to my general lack of knowledge in all things handy. But on this particularly cold spring day in March, I believe it was, in 2008, Wendell and I had heard something interesting in the news as we were going to Menards for supplies. We heard that former President Bill Clinton was coming to town to campaign for his wife, Hillary, who is running for the nomination for Democratic, well, for President of the United States of America. Now, I can still picture Wendell Menards picking up the brackets, looking for the right color, complaining about whether or not Lois might be able to scrape all the stickers off of these certain brackets, to then turn to me and ask a very simple yet loaded question. He said, "You want to have some fun?" Now, my initial thought was, wait, I'm already having the time of my life. What could be more exciting than going to Rich's Cafe for lunch, going to save big money at Menards, carrying planks outside in the snow, holding brackets to a frozen wall in a part of the church we don't heat throughout the week? Wasn't this fun already? What could you add to this experience? But Wendell wasn't thinking about shelves. He was thinking about something else. He was thinking about capitalizing on the political buzz to raise awareness of something reprehensible, the enduring slaughter of children in America. And I told Wendell, "I'm listening." A few hours later, I was once again in the cold, without Wendell, but there was no chance of running back to my office to thaw out in the heat in the office of the church. There was only springtime rain, soggy shoes, and plenty of angry people, again, not including Wendell. But standing next to the, not that time anyway, standing next to the youth and the youth sponsors, though, I was energized, because we had a very simple plan. And our plan, as many of you know who are here, our plan was simply to stand with signs reading "Abortion kills children" and speak to those who speak to us as they came and left from the rally. And our plan was to use science and philosophy we learned from Scott Klusendorf and others. And now that night, I was prepared for people to take my scientific evidence and say that's wrong or dispute it, or look at my philosophical arguments and challenge them. But what I was not prepared for was everyone who would say, "So what?" People looked at our signs and said, "Abortion kills children? So does war." And with that simple phrase, they'd write off the atrocity of abortion as at best not bothersome, and at worst, not even a thing we should consider in the least. Now, I see a similar attitude today, even though I'm not in downtown Fort Wayne, on campuses across the country, the few that we go to once in a while. When I talk to students, they look at our signs and see bloody faces of children who've been killed. And they say, "Sure, they're human, but it doesn't really matter." They go on to justify abortion not because the preborn are not human, but because of overpopulation or bodily autonomy or something like that. Salon.com recently published an article on Merle Hoffman, a longtime abortion activist who carries the same sentiment. And the sentiment is this, which is very shocking to me. Merle Hoffman, like the students I see on campuses, do not dispute the humanity of the preborn. They don't argue against the preborn fetuses and embryos being human, but they justify killing them for other reasons. Merle Hoffman said in her article, she's also the founder of Choices, an abortion clinic in Queens, New York. She said, "You don't have to argue that abortion stops a beating heart. It does." She knows this. She's admitting it. She goes on to say it's okay to terminate that beating heart, not because it's not a human, but because by killing the fetus, a woman is at her most powerful moment in her life. This is Merle Hoffman's brand of feminism. She also justifies abortion by saying that doing this allows women to really love their families and love themselves. Now, this same sentiment of understanding the preborn are human and yet still accepting killing them is something, again, that I see on campuses and also with those who are perhaps not just students, but those who are higher people in our societies. Recently, when I was listening to hours of abortion advocate testimony in response to Ohio's heartbeat bill, legislation which would ban abortion after the medical detection of a fetal heartbeat, as I sat waiting for my turn to testify before the Ohio Senate Health, Aging, and Human Services Committee, I listened to hours of NARAL Planned Parenthood representatives and also doctors and pastors get up, and every single one accepted that a beating heart is stopped at abortion, But every single one did not say that's not human, but they said we ought to be able to kill these fetuses for other reasons, like medical anomalies such as Down syndrome, making them not worthy of life. This is an alarming trend, the understanding that the preborn are human, yet that not being enough to protect her life. And so I would say that our task in America is harder than simply proving the preborn are human. I mean, to be honest, advances in embryology and other fields have made that pretty much moot. But now we have to respond to a world that has gone one step farther, a culture which says that being human just isn't enough, a culture which in truth has destroyed human equality. And so this is our goal this morning, to consider how we've gotten here and some ideas for how we can endeavor to restore human equality to all humans. And so I begin with a question. Are all humans created equal? Are we all created equal? Now, this might seem like a pretty obvious, the answer might seem very obvious to this question, right? The prevalence of this question alone in our society, from our founding documents to being echoed by social reformers like Dr. King in his celebrated I Have a Dream speech, the sheer prevalence of this statement, all men are created equal, may make us think, sure, yeah, we know that. Everyone's created equal. It's obvious. And so we're tempted to think everyone in America accepts this. And that's why it's also tempting to think that abortion is a no-brainer. We're all created equal. The preborn are humans, and therefore it's wrong to kill them. But there's a dirty little truth undermining this in our culture, and that is simply this, that a secular society, while it may arbitrarily assert equality, has no real justification for doing so. Let me explain. A few months ago, I got to the Created Equal office in the morning, and I did what I do every morning, fired up my computer and started looking for news items related to bioethical issues. And that morning, I found an interesting article in the United Kingdom's The Guardian, written by Nick Spencer. And it was titled, The Political Bible, Part 5, Equality. And I was actually very, very interested in this article because it had some really good ideas. In the article, Nick Spencer began to explain the ramifications of Darwinian thought. He said that even if humans are all the same species, the various evolutionary routes we take, some to places of power, some to places of servanthood, that inequality is legitimized and justified by our evolutionary routes. He then notes this that you have on the screen. We should not, therefore, underestimate how counterintuitive and how countercultural human equality is. What Spencer knows and what he was writing is if Darwinian thought theory holds, if we're merely a cosmic oops burped out by a cold, uncaring world, there's no basis whatsoever for human equality. We're each of us without dignity. There's no value to what it means to be human, and therefore no right, real binding equality among us. But Spencer continues. He writes that, nor should we underestimate the extent to which our contemporary commitment to equality is drawn from biblical Christianity. At this point, I was like cheering in my office. Whoa, in The Guardian? This is very cool. Spencer, what he is saying here is that unlike the secular worldview, the Christian worldview has an authentic anchor for human equality, the making of man in God's image. Spencer himself quotes Genesis 1 that we know well, 1:26-27. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. All humans, from the one-celled zygote to the elderly grandfather, share this image of God equally. And thus, there's a real reason to believe that all humans have the same dignity, that they are equal. Now, compare this to the secular doctrine of what man is, the great-great-grandchild of primordial goo. Is it any surprise whatsoever to us that that worldview fails to have a basis for human equality? Now, you could argue that the Christian tenet of equality has had a great influence in our culture. That's a really good point to make. The students that I meet today, though, I fear, are beginning to connect the dots. They're beginning to see that their worldview does not allow for that binding universal human equality, and many of them, I fear, are accepting it. And this is how they justify killing the preborn humans. They say, yes, they're humans, but this is how they're viewing the abortion debate, the killing of thousands of embryos and fetuses daily. They're viewing it as, yes, they may be human, but they're not equal, so it's okay to kill them. And this is why the abortion debate is more than just killing children. That is what we're talking about when we talk about abortion. But it's about more than that. It cuts to the core of how we view all men. And this is why Francis Schaeffer said long ago that this is the watershed issue of our time, because it reveals what we believe man to be and if we place any value whatsoever on his life. It's been said in the 18th century, Man killed the Bible. 1 century later, man killed God. And in the 20th century, man killed man because man had his own reason, didn't need God anymore. But then man killed man, cut off from his divine source of value. He had no ultimate value. And we see what happened in the wars of the 20th century. And I submit that in the 21st century, as we continue to slaughter 3,300 children every day, this has not changed. Indeed, I think we are hammering these nails deeper into our coffin and making us wonder how long, if ever, can we arise from this fractured, terrible worldview. Now, this morning, I'm just going to share with you two such nails in our coffin, if you will, as we've killed ourselves and as we continue to bury ourselves. Two nails, I think, are being pounded deeper into our coffin. And the first one is the splintering of man. The splintering of man. Biblical Christianity sees man as a unified whole, body and spirit. Man is not a meaningless biological shell indwelt by a valuable spirit. Rather, he's an entity whose flesh and spirit are united in the valuable person we know as human. His value is not rooted in either flesh or spirit alone, but rather in God's image placed upon him as a body-spirit unity. Biblical Christianity further, therefore, confirms that there's an enduring human nature or substance which remains constant. Ourselves, all of ourselves in our bodies, are constantly dividing, dying off, and being replaced. But our identity, who we are, remains constant. I remain I over time. Seth will always be Seth, even though his cells change. But America's love affair with scientific naturalism has cast aside this understanding, and as a result has splintered man into an odd combination of a meaningless mass of matter and a curious spiritual yearning to be something more than that. Now, by scientific naturalism, just to quickly define, I mean the worldview that the natural world is all that there is, and that we should only believe what can be proven by science. This worldview leads to the conception of man, or man's physical nature, not being part of a valuable unified whole, but instead being a pointless, as I said, blob of goo. J.P. Moreland, in his chapter in William Lane Craig and Chad Meister's book, God is Great, God is Good, he has a chapter called The Image of God and the Failure of Scientific Naturalism. And in that chapter, he quotes Berkeley professor John Searle as saying the following. John Searle says, there's exactly one overriding question in contemporary philosophy. How do we fit in? How can we square the self-conception of ourselves as mindful, meaning-creating, free, rational, etc. agents with a universe that's consists entirely of mindless, meaningless, unfree, non-rational, brute physical particles? Unlike the Christian, the scientific naturalist sees everything about man as being absolutely accidental. Whereas the Christian is justified in valuing man's physical nature as part of God's good creation, the naturalist counters that man's biology is of no consequence whatsoever and has no ultimate value. And the naturalist also rejects this idea of an enduring human nature over time. There's no enduring substance to who you are. Instead, you're merely the meaningless sum of meaningless parts. Man, therefore, has been splintered. No longer does the fact that man is a member of the human species really mean anything important. Instead, that statement, man is human, is seen as a bland description of aimless existence. To be human doesn't guarantee any inherent nature, any imprint of God. It means that man has biology, which is at its core aimless, without purpose or meaning. Indeed, man's physical nature is of really no import whatsoever. And because of this, man cannot point to his physical existence as any evidence of his value. Now, this fracturing, this idea of redefining life as splitting it off from biological life is clearly evident in the abortion debate. And let me illustrate quickly. Sorry, this is John Searle's picture for you. Let me quickly illustrate with a video that I shot last fall at Ohio State University. Brian, can you do that? Sorry, I guess I can't find it.
When do you say life begins? That's a good question. It's a philosophical question that everybody has to answer. Because it goes to what you religiously believe. It goes to different religions. It goes to people's different beliefs.
How do you know those blades of grass are not human?
Because they're grass.
Is that a philosophical question or is that a scientific
question? That's a scientifically objective question.
What about a fetus? Is that a scientific question? Is it human? Or is it a philosophical question?
I think it's both.
But whether or not it's human, can't that be determined scientifically?
There's debate there. You can ask if... I can't answer that question. You have to ask because you'll have a scientist that'll say a fetus is
Scientist isn't human. What if a scientist told you the grass is human? Would he be right or wrong?
The scientific evidence that it's not.
What about scientific evidence when it comes to when life begins?
There is no scientific evidence. There is no scientific evidence. There is no scientific evidence. There is no question about grasping humanity. There's way too many views in the scientific community, and if you take religious belief out alone, there's too many views in the scientific community just in science that does not know when life begins.
And my point in showing you this video is not to expose his scientific ignorance of the evidence for the beginning of life, but to show you how this question, when life begins, has been redefined in our culture, how it's interpreted today. For this student, the question, when does life begin, is not answered with any kind of scientific evidence. It's an open-ended question of philosophy. And in fact, in conversations about when does human life begin, scientific evidence is seen as a futile distraction. Because remember that what matters is not physical life. That physical existence of being human biologically is meaningless. That has no value. What matters is when life becomes valuable. And for human life to be valuable, you don't have to be just biologically human. You need something added to you. And that's the open philosophical question we have today. So in discussions of what makes humans valuable, science, namely biology, when we become human, has been jettisoned. Whether or not the preborn are human, for example, means really nothing. That doesn't really matter. What matters is, are they valuable humans? Now, are they human? Are they valuable humans? And this is why the abortion debate has turned from defining the humanity of the preborn to establishing personhood. What you are as a human is really of no consequence. What matters is whether or not you are a person, and that is not guaranteed by human DNA in our culture today. Human personhood is something gained, not something immediately shared by all who are human. Nancy Piercy, in her book Saving Leonardo, a manifesto exposing the secular assault on minds, morals, and meaning, drills this point home with a quote from Yale professor Paul Bloom. And Paul Bloom says this: the question of when life begins is not really about life in any biological sense. It is instead about the magical moment at which a cluster of cells becomes more than a mere physical thing. When later questioned about what that magical moment was, Paul Bloom said, that's not a question a scientist ever could answer. He was incredulous. He didn't understand why he would ever try to define life in a scientific way, because human life is not biological existence, it's something added to it. Valuable life, therefore, has been divorced from any sort of biological understanding of life. Instead, it's something magical which comes later, and man, therefore, has been truly fractured. He's biologically human, but any value he could ever have comes later, has to be established apart from his simple existence. Now, the second nail in man's coffin after being fractured follows logically from the first. Because human value is not automatically secured for all who are human, man is forced to eternally carry the burden of proving his value, a burden which becomes truly fruitless. And another quote for you, Peter Singer, the abortion advocate who gets the award for being the most consistent abortion advocate with his assertion that we should allow infanticide, he writes this in Practical Ethics. He writes, the belief that mere membership of our species, irrespective of other characteristics, makes a great difference to the wrongness of killing a being, is a legacy of religious doctrines. Singer says that it's not wrong to kill humans just because they're humans. It's wrong to kill them because they are valuable if they have certain qualities. Thus, to say that it's wrong to kill humans because they're human just can't make sense in light of scientific naturalism. Because, again, there's nothing valuable about merely being human. And so now we understand why our culture, if it is to be logically consistent, must reject the assertion that all humans are created equal. That simply cannot exist in the worldview we've allowed. They must reject that. We could say all humans are created, or at least somehow produced, but you could never say they have any common value. That can't exist. And so this prompts the question, if it's not wrong to kill humans because they're human, why is it wrong to kill them? And this is a question which the gatekeepers of our society, frankly, are struggling to answer. Because what has ensued is a free-for-all, where everyone posits their own theory of whence value originates. Peter Singer says it's self-awareness. Others say it's environment, whether or not the fetus is outside the womb. Others say it's ability to survive as an independent being, meaning perhaps that abortion would be immoral after viability. But as Scott Klusendorf has pointed out, these are all arbitrary. What if he said it's having a belly button? These are all he said, she said theories. None of them have an objective grounding. They cannot be proven right or wrong. This move from a biological definition of life to an open-ended philosophical debate of personhood leaves us in a truly dangerous place. Because we have moved from the objective to the subjective. It's an exchange of objective for subjective. We can know objectively if something is human, but personhood is up to every person to define for themselves. Everyone in America, every ethicist has become their own arbiter of what makes a valuable human being. Because with scientific evidence discarded, there's no objective line in the sand to define humanity. And this confusion of myriad theories of what makes a human valuable brings, I think, a new chilling question to the fore. And that is this. Without an objective standard to define humanity, today the preborn are ruled out. But what's to prevent the consensus from tomorrow ruling out segments of born humans? Even those who are not bothered by the daily decapitation, disembowelment, and dismemberment of preborn babies ought to take note here. Because, in truth, with universal equality being a relic of the past, how do we determine the value of a human being? Without a common human nature shared by all, evidenced by their membership in the human species, what value becomes reduced to usually becomes function. The question becomes not what are you, but what purpose are you serving? What are you contributing to society? Prior to the wholesale destruction of Jews and other groups in the era of World War II, the slaughter of humans by the Nazi regime began with the other groups. It began with those who had physical, emotional, and mental handicaps, people deemed useless eaters who were taking resources from society but not producing anything. An article by Mark Mostert that appeared in the Journal of Special Education responded to this. It was that he was trying to consider what context could take a civilized society and allow them to go from what they are as a civilization to killing large groups of humans. And Mark Mostert quoted professors Carl Binding and Alfred Hook, professors who in 1920 produced a tract that was called Permission for the Destruction of Life Unworthy of Life. And in this tract, the professors called for the killing of people with disabilities because they were, as they called them, uncurable idiots. Mark Mostert summarizes their views that the right to life was something to be earned, not assumed. He writes, "This shifted the burden of human existence from simply being alive to requiring an explicit justification for living. Simply being alive is not enough. Being biologically human is not enough. You have to have a justification on top of that for why we should allow you to remain alive." Now, maybe we're slower in 21st century America, but this idea is the same one that has taken root in our land. Simply being alive, simply being human, does not amount to a justification for living. You have to give an explicit justification for your life. You must bear the burden of proving your value, and you cannot point to your biological makeup as evidence of that value, because again, that biological makeup is pointless. So think again about the preborn babies. Everyone who's taken an honest look at the evidence knows that they are living humans, in fact. But can preborn children give an explicit justification for their life, why we should keep them around? No, they can't. And I think it gets worse. Because not only can they not contribute to society, but they have something we want in the way of stem cells for our research. But, again, this is not only a concern for the preborn. What about other people groups in America? How long until we connect the dots and begin to kill born humans who are not contributing? Now you may think, okay, Seth is just being an alarmist today. My purpose is not to just scare you all into bunkering down into Wendell's wooded house with your bitterly clinging to guns and Bibles, but you might want to keep those at your side. I'm not suggesting that, although Wendell might appreciate that. Moving the church in his house could be fun. Maybe you wouldn't appreciate that living there. I'm not suggesting tomorrow we'll see a Holocaust of born humans, but here is what I know. That is the logical conclusion of our culture's view. Perhaps God will spare us that additional horror, but we should not sit by idly and wait for it not to happen. I neither wish to be alarmist, nor do I wish to say we should only defend preborn children to save our own skin, save born human skin. That's not my point either. Here is my point, to show you how much is at stake in the abortion debate. Now, I know the people in this room. We are moved by the deaths of preborn humans, but I know so many who are not willing to put their names in the line, people who are not moved by death tolls of 42 million across the globe every year of preborn children. That doesn't bother them. Just recently, I received an email from a campus group at Ohio State University after requesting to network with them, and they wrote back and said, no, we don't want to because we don't take a position on abortion. What the American church does not understand is that in so doing, they're not only failing to follow God's command to love our neighbors, defend the poor and the needy, but they're allowing the perpetuation of an utterly godless worldview that writes out not only the value of the preborn, but also eliminates their own human dignity. This might move, I hope, even the American church, who is too embarrassed or too lazy to engage in the debate for the children. For if the preborn are not valuable, neither are we. We must not fail to publicly challenge and consistently speak against this idea that humans are not valuable by virtue of being humans. This is admittedly a daunting task, because we're not only fighting ignorance of what the preborn are, we're sparring with an appalling worldview that is choking our mannishness, wresting away all conscience, and leaving behind a cold world of Darwinian machines who care not for humans whatsoever. But we must. We must challenge it, and we must do so boldly. So today I'm going to give you four suggestions for how we should continue to do so. The first one is show abortion advocates the true horror of their view. If we're good at one thing in America today, it's holding a worldview without ever following it through to its logical conclusions. We do that great. Many abortion advocates whose thinking falls in line with what I've shared today do not understand that their rejection of a human, enduring human nature and human value for the preborn also leads to rejection of their value. They've not followed it through to its conclusion. And even those who do connect the dots live under this illusion that those in power could never turn on them. We must burst this bubble of false comfort. And so much of arguing for the preborn is truly just showing them the blackness of their own worldview that they've adopted. Because until they understand that their worldview is terrifying, until they're convinced of that, they may not be willing to drop their frame of thinking for a new paradigm. And so in our conversations with those who've picked up on these ideas, the idea that something must be added to humanity to make him valuable, such as self-awareness, we need to show them that they've destroyed equality overall. And you can ask them questions. I mean, ask, for example, if humans are not valuable by virtue of being human, how do you know you're valuable? Or how can we justify equality at all? Or ask them, if equality like self-awareness or environment gives you value, do we give more rights to those who have more of it, more self-awareness, than those who have less of it? Or ask them, if we're mere conglomerations of meaningless matter, how can we have any true purpose in this world? Your goal should be to destroy the hedge they've created in their mind, walk them to the end of their view, and show them the world it creates, a truly horrifying world. And once you've done that, number two, show them that they nevertheless yearn for equality and meaning. This is amazing, but this worldview they've made in their mind, which cannot give a compelling justification for human equality, does not destroy their yearning for it. They still do. Consider this poster from recently we were at the University of Central Florida doing training and outreach, and the National Organization for Women Students Group of NOW came out with their poster, and they had this on it, which I'm sorry, you may not be able to read, but I'll read it for you. They said, "Do you believe that women should control their lives?" Calling for equality, that men supposedly control their lives and women should be able to too. "Do you believe in equality? Do you believe in social justice? Do you believe in ending violence and discrimination?" This is the most curious poster held by those who deny inherent human rights, who believe that humans are meaningless blobs of goo, who reject the idea that we're all created equal. It's a very odd poster that they're carrying, but the truth is they still yearn for equality even though they can't substantiate it. So tell them, walk up to these people and say, "Yes, I believe in equality. Where do you think it comes from?" Watch them wrestle with the conclusion of their worldview and what just seems right inside of them, because they still have God's law written on their hearts. And number three, share the good news. There's a reason to uphold equality. Once you've shown someone the terrifying world that their idea creates, once you've shown them how they've destroyed human meaning and enduring human quality across the species, and once you've brought to light their inner yearnings for that equality, share the good news that there is a way to establish equality. When we evangelize, there are generally two main principles that we share. The first one is the bad news: man is dead. Number two, the good news: God gave a way to bring man back to life. We can follow a similar pattern when challenging the worldview, killing children, and destroying human equality and dignity generally. Number one, share the bad news. The bad news is the American zeitgeist, or spirit of our age, creates no reason to believe that all humans are anything valuable or have any common equality. But then we can share the good news that biblical Christianity not only offers reason to value man, but also establishes universal rights across the family of man. I think we often think about fighting abortion as just sharing bad news. Indeed, we cannot leave that part out. We must boldly share the bad news that America is killing human beings at an alarming rate. But there's also good news to share, and that is that a world which yearns for equality and meaning in spite of their rejection thereof is hungry for it, and we can share that with them. So we should share that good news. And number four, use your apologetics. Give an active defense. The classic purpose of apologetics, as you know, is to give a defense. It's not to fill our minds with excellent material to allow the information to then sit there. Sometimes I fear that we all read 1 Peter 3:15, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope you have, and think that our job is just to be prepared. We should just think about it and then wait, and the pagans will come knocking at our door, and when they do, we'll be ready to tell them what we think. But that preparation is only the starting point. Paul's words in 2 Corinthians 10:5 certainly conveys more of an active engagement. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. We take captive every thought to make obedient to Christ. This doesn't sound like passive waiting for someone to knock on our door and ask, what do you think about the preborn? And what do you think about human equality? In his classic work, The God Who Is There, Francis Schaeffer writes this: Christian apologetics is not like living in a castle with the drawbridge up and occasionally tossing a stone over the walls. Apologetics should not be merely an academic subject, a new kind of scholasticism. It should be thought out and practiced in the rough and tumble of living contact with the present generation. Apologetics are meant to be used, not harbored. I would not say there's no point to apologetic knowledge if not used. Certainly it gives us confidence and builds our faith. But that's not meant to be the ending point. We're meant to use what we know to speak to this generation. So if it's knowledge you lack, there are plenty of resources to recommend. But once you have that knowledge in place, use it. Are you sitting behind a castle wall and waiting for abortion advocates to knock on your door? Or are you seeking them out? If you don't know how to find them, it can be very easy. If you just go to a street corner and hold a sign with the face of the death of human equality, the face of a dead child, they'll find you. A couple of months ago, in our morning meeting, my boss, Mark Harrington, said to me that if we end abortion but fail to conquer this worldview, the evil will just rear its head in another way. And I think he's right, because even if we stop the killing of preborn children, this idea that humans are not valuable by virtue of being human, but when something magical is added to them later on, if we end the killing of children, that may rear its head another way. We may kill other groups of humans. So we must end abortion, because ripping a child violently from his mother's womb by the thousands every day is truly the greatest human rights injustice ever to see the world. But in so doing, we must go to the heart of the worldview that's feeding this killing. We must challenge it head on, because restoring dignity to all men and championing universal human equality for everyone made in the image of God is, in fact, the only way to truly end this evil notion that humans are not created equal, and end the killing of children, and make sure we don't kill other humans who are created equal as well. So this time we're going to have the musicians come forward. No.
Take a couple questions.
Oh, okay. We're going to take questions. No, that's fine. I like that. Yeah, I tried to make it timely. So.
You were right on the
perfect.
I miss you, Seth.
I miss building shells with you, Wendell. Becky?
So
well, okay, that's a good question that perhaps actually in this room there could be others who could answer better than I have, because admittedly, I have been in the abortion battle for a much shorter time than they have. So what I know is that the few years I've been on college campuses, this has been there. Because this worldview is not something that has sprouted recently, but I do think that the acceptance of it is something that is more blatant now. So if I've been doing this for 3 or 4 years, that whole time I've seen this, but it's not what I've understood it to be before. But what do you want to?
I would speculate that this is not what caused Roe v. Wade, but Roe v. Wade, you know, came to us in another form, but another reason. But now that has fueled this whole worldview for sure.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yeah. I would definitely say that my understanding has changed. I think when I began, I thought that's all I have to do, just prove they're humans. And I've learned now that's not the case.
In history, do we have a timeline that we've seen in Germany and Europe from when they went from philosophically talking about devaluing humans?
Well, I think there would be a couple things. You consider, like, the professors I quoted were writing in 1920. We know that it was, you know, decades later that they were killing the Jews and rounding them up in that way. But already it had taken root across the culture. Hitler's propaganda was very strong, giving the ideas that the Jews themselves were parasites, and the propaganda pieces like this, that those who aren't contributing are unworthy of life. But I think that even if we could look at a timeline for how exactly that happened back then, it would be different today with how ideas are exchanged today. It's not the same with tracts being sent out and printed and being passed around by people. Information passes a lot faster today. So I would wager that things could move more quickly. Again, I'm not trying to be alarmist to say we're having a Holocaust of born humans tomorrow, but I do think that it's easier for people to get that concept. If you think of Francis Schaeffer's Line of Despair, too, how the ideas go down from the academics to the man on the street. Today you see these ideas in our movies, and you see people talking about things like this on Facebook, so this idea is certainly rampant now in society. But I would tell you that one example of how this can move from preborn to born is Peter Singer's view of killing born children, infanticide, because they're not self-aware. It's still a minority of the people that I talk to who are abortion advocates that accept that view, infanticide should be allowed, but it is there. So that idea has already started to cross over, but it's still a small amount. Unfortunately, what happens sometimes is they have to run for their bus, right, when we get to that point. I think that one – try to think of one example to give to you – was a guy at University of Toledo this year. Excuse me. And he – I don't know if he was a professor or just an older student on the campus. I don't really know. But he was the rare person that was honest with me on the spot and just started – he was just swearing up a storm, saying, I can't believe this. This is crazy. And he was really scared. You could see him really fighting with that tension between his worldview and what he feels to be right inside and what he thinks should be right anyway. And so I have seen people come to grips with it. And I think that at least, if nothing else, they leave – really shaken up because they understand their worldview cannot justify what the equality they yearn for. And so, how many of them become pro-life Christian converts, as far as how many just struggle with that later on, I don't know, because many people, you know, on the spot will not admit they've changed their mind to you. But I've seen plenty of people shaken up, and I do see those who are admitting they're wrong. So I don't know if that answers your question, Becky. Jess. Absolutely. That's actually, I think, if there's one thing encouraging, that's what it is. The students who are, and when they hear this, even students who, if you're just giving them pro-life apologetics, they know abortion is wrong, but they eat it up when they hear it. I mean, we've heard Scott Klusendorf many, many times at Fort Wayne, but I go to colleges and they've never heard these things, SLED or embryology, and they're so empowered by that. And when they hear this, their worldview is not this antiquated old system that creates all kinds of inequality, but it's the only one that actually upholds that. They become very excited to really share their faith in a way that they've never really known how to do before. So I find that to be very exciting, and that's why I think that we have to have the two in place. You have to be training people for this kind of defense. We have to help them actually start doing it. Otherwise, it just remains that scholastic idea in their mind. So that is what's encouraging, I think. All right. Oh, can I take Nate's?
Yeah. Well, you touched on things that just various aspects of your ministry and sort of what you do with outreach and stuff. Can you give kind of a comprehensive overview of what it is how it differentiates from CBR and what exactly it is that you're doing with?
Certainly. Yeah, the Center for Bioethical Reform, when I started there with Mark Harrington, my boss, who's still my boss, our project was a genocide awareness project. And we went to campuses and we would train students in apologetics and then have this large display. And as those of you who might have come to IPFW saw, it really creates a lot of buzz on the campus. The only, and I still strongly encourage GAP project, excuse me, and support it. What we saw was a need to do something different. Because this truly is a worldview problem that we are facing, going to a campus once every few years and having a great buzz, while that can be very effective, it will not be as effective as training and raising up missionaries on the campuses to have a consistent effort there. And that consistent effort that we're using now is smaller signs, because students can't purchase a whole Gap project and put it up every day, but they can hold these signs on campuses. And so our effort now is focused on training those missionaries, if you will, on campuses, and giving them the tools they need and having a consistent relationship with them. Something the Genocide Awareness Project certainly could do, but we just wanted to tweak it to make it something more, if you will, something they could more easily do. We use the word transferable. We can transfer science to them, transfer our knowledge to them, and help them, but we can't give them a whole Gap project. So that's truly the what changed there. So Mark and I now, we are smaller and more agile. We go to more campuses more quickly and train more students. And IPFW here is a great example of a campus where the students are doing what we want. They're holding the signs, they're talking to people, and creating that buzz. So that is the general reason for why things changed. So now those are our two goals, training and outreach. We go to campuses, train them, and lead them in that outreach. Does that answer your question? Thank you. At this time, now the musicians will come forward and we'll continue with musical worship.